we shall start a new scheme called the Home Savings Grant Scheme. People who save regularly with a building society will receive a grant in proportion to what they've saved themselves. So if you've saved, say, £5 a week, over at least 2 years, you'll be able to get a grant of £250. We shall start the scheme straight away, and it'll take 2 years to get it fully into action. By that time, the builders will be able to get enough extra houses ready.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keane and Phil Dobby.
Well, that was Margaret Thatcher in 1974 promoting what was probably the very first home buyers grant scheme, which, as we know, does nothing except push the price of houses up. Doesn't create more houses, even though she was expecting loads of them, clearly, to suddenly become on the market. But it was a vote winner back then because we've always all wanted to own our own house. We are obsessed with ownership. Is this obsession slowing the economy down and adding to the wealth divide? And what are the consequences if we just accepted that with housing, maybe most of us should just rent? And what other aspects of the economy? Do we have to own absolutely everything, or should we just rent more or subscribe more? And what are the consequences of that? We'll look at that this week on the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. So I wonder how much of the world's problems are accentuated or even originated by our quest for ownership. I mean, we've got some people own land, some people have very expensive houses, some people own companies. And those that don't own these things, well, they want them. They spend a lot of money saving in the hope that one day they will own those things. But actually, we often don't really own what we strive for. Ultimately, we don't get there. Only a minority own their house outright. By the time they do, it's probably too late. Most have a mortgage or they rent. Most don't own a car outright these days. They're paying off a loan or they're on a lease plan. And all of these ways are funding ambition to own something. But are we really just adding more funds to the finance sector when we do that, giving us the... They're the ones giving us the loans to buy something that we really can't afford, ultimately. Or should we perhaps own more? Here's another way of looking at it. For example, if we own more solar cells and a battery, then we could all reduce our power bills, and that would be a worthwhile investment, wouldn't it? Rather than paying a certain amount of money to the power company every month. But Steve, let's start with housing, because over the last 70 years, the average UK house price has risen by 365%, and that's on an inflation-adjusted basis. So here's the question. Is it inflated because so many of us want to own a house? And if so, how much less would that inflation be if, rather than us owning houses ourselves, if the government, and this is socialism in the extreme, but if the government owned all the housing in the country and we just paid rent to them, then presumably we wouldn't have this house price inflation.
Oh, no, we wouldn't be living in England anymore. We'd be calling a place Singapore, because that's fairly much the model that Singapore has gone with. There's enormous state ownership of housing, and it basically means anybody in Singapore can live in a house and not necessarily own one. But yeah, the real pattern, it isn't just the desire to own, because it was actually much, much easier to own a house in the 1950s. And this is not just in the UK, it's global. And the reason is because we've allowed too much borrowed money for buying houses. This is the foundation. We've let the finance sector expand dramatically from what it was 50, 60 years ago. Let's go right back to the beginning of the whole thing. Expand dramatically from what it got to be during the Great Depression, because too much debt during the 1920s is what caused the Great Depression, private debt. And the bursting of the bubble gave us 20 years of horror, the Great Depression and the Second World War. And after that, banks were put back into the corner they should remain in, and that what's happened ever since then, rising levels of debt, and over time we're back in the same overvalued situation for assets, which means that most people can't buy a house.
So how do you get around that? Do you say, well, okay, more social housing, the Singapore situation, that is turning, by the way, but we can talk about that in a second, but that idea, is that a better idea? Does that get over the problem? And what would happen then? Because we wouldn't be saving or spending a fortune on a mortgage, we'd just be paying rent. Wouldn't have anything at the end of the day to show for it, but you're dead anyway at the end of the day, aren't you?
Well, it's really just the impact of letting the finance sector dominate the economy. And we've got so used to this, that believing that the finance sector needs to be involved in virtually everything. You can see this in the policies of the new UK government. It was all about getting finance into housing, getting finance into water management, getting finance. Why do we have to have the intermediary, the finance sector, being as large as it is? And just to give an idea of the difference in scale, I had a Twitter correspondent make a comment about what would happen to the measure of GDP if you took out the finance sector and treating it as a cost of doing business rather than a source of profit. And I think that's quite a valid statement. Now, it didn't have a large impact, I must say. Looking at the numbers, I did the numbers in my new Ravel software very rapidly, and I expected that I'd find, you know, that my guess was he was probably right. You might find most of the GDP growth since the 1970s has been all going the finance sector. That wasn't the case. It had about the rate of growth without the finance sector was about 0.2 or 0.3% lower than with. So most of the growth, therefore, was coming from the non-finance sectors of the economy. But the impact was that over time, finance had gone from being about 8% of GDP to 20% of GDP. And that's just the bloated finance sector is the major cause of bloated asset prices. And since we've allowed housing to become an asset class rather than a long-term consumption item, housing has become unaffordable.
But it is that thing, isn't it? We're treating housing as an investment rather than as a consumption item. So is that it's our quest for, I wonder whether we can entirely blame the finance sector because we are allowing them to do it because we have this craving for our own house. And I'm just wondering if that attitude shifted, would that be a healthy thing? Or should we be, you know, or is it right that we should aspire to own our own house? I mean, we do feel pretty good about it when we do actually manage to get one. The problem is, of course, that increasing number of people will never have
one. It's understandable to want to own your own housing because you don't want to be beholden to a landlord telling you can and cannot put a nail on the wall to hang a painting. You can't make the changes, etc., etc. So we do have a desire to be able to rearrange our living situation, and that's constrained if you don't actually own it. So that's a reasonable attitude, and I can see why people want to own, but therefore, or you want to make the cost of owning really, you know, relative to income, it has to be sustainable. And there was a great ex-property developer in the New Zealand who used to run a website called Demographia. I haven't checked for it for ages now, but he used to keep an index of just how affordable versus unaffordable housing was. And as somebody who'd built thousands of homes himself, he said that the rule of thumb is that the cost of the average house should be no more than 2.5 times the average wage. Now, what we're looking at now is something which is of the order of 10 to 12 times the average income of a working person, and that's what it's all been driven by an increase in the amount of finance we allow people to use to buy a property.
10 to 12 of the household, presumably. I mean, if you had two working people, that would be 24 times the value of the household. Presumably, that's on a household basis. But either way,
it's on a household basis. Yeah.
It's a significant number, isn't it? So the Singapore situation. People are just spending more and more money, and the net effect of that obviously is they've got less money that they are spending in the broader economy. But an economist would say, yes, but that money's going somewhere, so you're paying it to the landlord. The landlord's got that money to spend in the broader economy.
And landlords are spending it at an outrageously high rate. You get them going to McDonald's every day because they've got what we're doing is handing over money to people who spend it more slowly. They accumulate more, and there's, you know, Bill Gates, I saw a calculation at one stage of just the size of the mini supernova that would happen if Bill Gates decided to consume all the wealth he's got before his expected life expectancy runs out. There's no way that people who are that wealthy will ever consume all that they have accumulated. So even though they've got a lot of money and they spend an outrageous amount compared to ordinary people, they're spending far less than if a large amount of the money was in the hands of ordinary people who have to spend more quickly because they haven't got as much money. So what we've had out of this is a declining velocity of circulation of money as well.
So why own then? What have you got to a situation where the government, and you know, this will never happen, but suppose the government said, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to build all the houses from now on, and we're going to make them quite nice houses. We'll make them different types, you know, for different income levels according to what you can afford. But they are going to be sensibly priced. There's going to be enough of them. We're going to meet supply. We're going to plan them. We're going to make sure they're in the places where the jobs are, almost like a centrally controlled. I think some people might say this is communism, but, you know, like a centrally controlled economy where the government owns all the property. If you want to add an extension or something like that, there'll be some sort of system for enabling that to happen. You know, we've got a catalogue, choose plan A, and the government will look after that for you because everyone will be living in the same sort of house. I mean, is that a dystopian future, or is that a bright future where everyone is not worried about ownership because they've got the safety? Because the reason we want ownership is because we want safety and security. If the government says, well, don't worry about that, we'll look after you. So this is also tongue-in-cheek. The government will look after you. Would we be in a better place?
Well, in fact, I'm not going to, you know, that's a fair bit of communist baiting there, so I'll let that pass. but the interesting comparison, apart from Singapore, one other interesting comparison is Germany. Now, I don't know if this is still the case, but I certainly have heard this said to me on numerous occasions by German colleagues, that the standard practice in a German rental property is that the tenant is responsible for the kitchen. I don't mean keeping it clean. putting the bloody thing in. The reason being that people, when you take out a rental lease in Germany, it used to be the case, again, I'm not sure that it's still the case now, that you might be there for 10, 15, 20 years. And the rules were set up in such a way that the tenant had a level of rights to the property that far exceed what applies in countries like the UK or Australia, which have, you know, plenty of experience there as a young man, and you get 6 month lease, and that's it. You're out after 6 months because the landlord.
Okay, but maybe that must be the law that's allowing that to happen. Or
the
just
law must allow. Yeah, the law must. They set up in such a way that is a right.
But it's still not a good thing, is it? So I mean, so in the UK, Australia, and the US, about 2/3 of all properties are owner-occupied, and about half of those or more people are still paying the mortgage off, but you know, people have on their way to owning their own house. In Switzerland, it's only about 40%. In Germany, less than 50% own their own house, so more than half are renting. And in Switzerland, it's even more renting. But I think in the case of Germany and Switzerland, it's because the houses are just so expensive. People are forced to rent. You know, so it's the same deal, only more so in those countries. So okay, in Germany, you know, you can fit the kitchen yourself and you can do a bit of work around the house, and you've got the same house for a long time. But it's still the same deal, isn't it? You're paying a landlord. The landlord is raking it in, probably has loads of these properties because there's so many more, the market is so much bigger for rental property there. So it's not a good thing, is it?
No. I was actually, you know, I ran for Parliament highly unsuccessfully in Australia, 2 years ago. And what I looked at was what's been the impact of government policy over time on housing. And the orientation of the policy, the intention of the policy was to increase home ownership. And when you took a look at the numbers, ever since the policy came in, the proportion of people who own their houses has been falling. And the reason is simple, that the government gives money to people to buy a house, and they then take that money to the bank effectively as a deposit, and by paying the deposit, they with the extra money coming in from the government, they lever that up by a factor of 10, and what you get out of that is higher house prices. So they've got the higher compared to income, prices are going faster than income has been growing, as you said in the introduction. The policy has actually had the opposite effect to what was intended. The reason simply is you don't want to, if you want to make housing affordable, you don't give money to the buyer, which you then let them lever up through the finance sector. But that's precisely what's been done.
There's only one way, really, isn't there? Which is to build more social housing. Which is that, you know, so for a lot of people, they don't own, and it gets back to the government owns. Maybe not for everybody, but, you know, a sizable proportion of the population don't own because the government provides it for those people who literally can't afford to get on the housing ladder. That would lower the entire property market, presumably. But they'd have to significantly, obviously, increase supply, which is one of the biggest problems we've got.
Well, that's the, I mean, the problem about housing, the reason why it's such a different industry to any other is, first of all, houses don't go off as fast as bottles of milk, so the house lasts an enormous length of time. They cost a damn sight more than a bottle of milk, so you can't use it paid out of cash. You've got to lever up somehow the amount of money you have to buy. And all these factors mean that you get caught up in levered purchasing of housing. But the problem on the supply side is that you can basically treat the supply as constant because the rate of change of supply is so slow. And this is like, a lot of people, they pull out the chopsticks of supply and demand and try to analyze it all and say, you know, if we need to get it, we've got to increase the level of supply. The thing is, it takes so long to build a house. And so with that an immense length of time involved and the immense amount of labor involved in doing it as well, you simply cannot increase the housing. You can't control housing by simply trying to increase the supply unless you do it on the scale that used to exist with council housing in the UK and the state housing in Singapore, where you just build an enormous volume. So whatever's done by the state is always constrained by the belief the government shouldn't run a deficit, and you end up with not enough being done, and they continue saying, oh, we should do more of this, but they never will do the level of building that's required.
So I think we're saying ownership is fine if you're owning the house that you live in, but private landlords make the situation worse. Well, if the state was to provide all of that, then we'd be in a healthier position, provided they could spend the money to do it. Where does that money come from? Well, yeah, you could use modern monetary theory as the rationale, or you could say, well, actually, we're going to budget, which amounts to almost the same thing, slightly differently, and that anything which is an investment that has a payback to it will treat as an off-budget item. And, you know, this obviously will pay it back. Very clear to make the business case. The government just needs to create the money to create the houses. Can't understand why that argument's not used, and why we're not seeing more social housing being built anywhere in the world. But actually, what we've got almost everywhere is that the housing supply, not only is it not growing, it's not even keeping up with the growth in the population. So as every year goes by, the situation in terms of supply just gets worse.
Yeah, I mean, I saw an interesting little, again, this is looking at stats on Twitter. There was, Office of National Statistics in the UK showing the number of houses being built over time. And if you go back far enough, of course, there was the period where the UK government was building council housing. Remember the old song, "My old man's a dustman, he wears a dustman's hat, he wears cord blimey trousers, he lives in a council flat." That was common enough to make it into a pop song. Not a very good pop song, but nonetheless. But that attitude was supported by the level of state construction of housing. And when it was decided, oh, this is terrible, we've got to get the market in there, the market will do things better, there was virtually no change in the level of private provision. So this is the peculiarity of housing, that people think about, everybody gets that ridiculous, as I'm saying on some of my posts on Patreon and Substack, this meme of supply and demand, you know, upward sloping supply, downward sloping demand curve, heaven is where the two lines intersect type thinking. And they apply it to everything when it is simply a very inadequate model of virtually everything, but especially industries like housing, where it is so hard to increase the supply. If you want to, double the construction of housing, you've got to double the number of workers involved. You've got to train them. It's going to take you 8 to 12 months to build each of the individual houses. You need to get the approvals. The whole thing is designed for the most sluggish supply response you can possibly ask.
Yeah, yeah, and then you've got to get workers in to build those houses from overseas, and then they need somewhere to live. So it goes on. Absolutely. Look, when we come back, I don't just want to talk about housing, but I think we could talk, finish off a bit more about, this drive for ownership. But, where else does ownership create a problem? I'm still not quite sure whether ownership of a house is a necessary evil or not, but we'll explore all of that a bit more when we come back on the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Back in a moment.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keane and Phil Dobby.
So this week we're looking at ownership, in particular housing ownership, but there's, other areas of ownership where it may be a good or a bad thing. We do have this desire, don't we, to own stuff, and then we die. And then we pass on that stuff, or it gets given to charity shops, or whatever. But in the case of our house, obviously it gets passed down, you know, the estate gets passed on to the kids. That adds to the next generation. House prices go up even higher, and so on. It just gets worse and worse. And those people who miss out continue missing out for generations. It's almost like a dystopian future, isn't it, Steve? And even worse now, those private landlords that we were talking about in the first part, even they're struggling to, you know, make the investment in their second or third properties. So it's large corporations now that are building these houses or blocks and then renting them out. So large corporations have got control on people's lives in a way, because, you know, that's the thing. The reason you own, as you said, because you want to be able to do something to the house. You know, you want to know how much it's going to cost you, you know, you don't want to get turfed out. Large corporations could be the ones turfing you out. You know, they take control of your lives. That is a very dystopian future.
Well, that's actually, again, back to what our good mate Yanis Varoufakis a few podcasts back, talking about techno-feudalism. And that's what we're ending up in. We have such... There will always be inequality in human societies. That is just a given. There's inequality in virtually everything which has an evolutionary foundation to it. You know, big earthquakes are much, much more powerful than... much, much rarer than small earthquakes. Big incomes are much, much rarer, but much, much larger than small ones. You'll always have an inequality. But we've let it be amplified by letting the leverage that people can take in become far more excessive than it was back in the 50s and 60s. And this, again, it's a combination of the finance sector with all the other factors that give us inequality in capitalism. I mean, it's hyper inequality now, and a large number of people are effectively falling back into a form of feudalism.
So, should we allow it to happen? Should our lives be determined by people with money making decisions about where they invest? And we are mere pawns in that game. I mean,
the main argument for capitalism, the main argument for private ownership of the means of production, is innovation. And the thing is, yes, homes these days have got some modern innovation. They've still got walls, they've still got floors, they've still got roofs. There are things about housing which are never going to change because it's an absolutely essential characteristic of the property class. Whereas we now have, you know, telephones we carry with each other. We're talking about drones for transport rather than the cars. There's innovation occurs far more rapidly in other industries apart from housing, and that is one of the areas where you think, well, the main thing is you simply want to have a sufficient housing for people not to be worried about the housing, and therefore they can focus on other activities, which is where your innovation could potentially come from. We're excluding them from that, so letting this housing get to be so expensive and out of reach for so many people means that we end up with a form of feudalism rather than the innovative nature of capitalism.
But even if you had that innovative approach coming out in housing, say there was a way that a company said, well, okay, we now own so many properties for so many people, and we're going to keep on doing that. We are going to build properties to rent out. And we found that we can, you know, mass manufacture in factories and ship and locate and produce stuff much more cheaply and much more cost effectively. That means the property will cost less, therefore we can charge people less. That won't happen, will it? Because the price is not determined by the cost. The price is determined by how much people are able to pay. And, you know, it gets back to, and I know you're saying it's not supply, but it is part of it, isn't it? If you were racing around trying to find somewhere to rent, you're going to pay what you have to pay rather than being homeless.
And that's certainly, a lot of people experience that right now. But like one thing that it is an issue with, as I said, building a house is still a craft industry. It is not something where you mass produce the houses. The essence of capitalism, and Ricardo got this right way back in 1816, he said the essence of capitalism is mass production. Now, housing is something you can't mass produce. So we're allowing the same system to apply to both mass-produced and non-mass-producible products, and it, because it works badly in the non-mass-producible products. This is one reason that I'm quite fascinated by, I think it's called box housing or something of that nature, but a company which has now worked out ways, one of several, to mass-produce housing. And what you buy is a set of modules you assemble together to make the actual house you want. But it's literally a house can go up in a day. And I think they might take 2 weeks to make it in a factory, but 2 weeks is a damn sight less than, you know, as I'm going through getting a house built in Bangkok right now, which getting to the point it's finally start, I'm looking at a year before the thing will be finished. So the time delays and the craft nature of the construction of housing is a major reason why it fits so badly into a capitalist system. And for that reason, it is something where you can consider, you know, state ownership and state provision of the physical services until such time as it's mass producible.
Yeah. I did see one of those mass produced houses, by the way. They make a lot of them in Germany, and we were thinking of getting one, but my wife didn't like it. By their very nature, they sort of like, they lend themselves to being quite open plan housing, which I love, but my wife doesn't like it very much. She prefers smaller rooms, etc. But it looked very good, and I saw one in situation that had been built and fantastic. But then, you know, you've got to find the land for it, so it's not, again, it's not a mass produced thing. It's a, you know, you can't,
again, and this is one reason for the Henry George argument that land is, you know, nobody is, a lot of the speculators themselves will say this, they're not making any more land, and the geographic nature of the product is another issue that gets in the way of it being like a typical market. So if you look, you know, mobile phones, there's always going to be room for another mobile phone to link onto a particular frequency in the broadcast spectrum. There's a limit of number of frequencies, but there's no real limit on how many machines can attach to one particular frequency. So you don't have geographic constraints. In housing, obviously you have geographic constraints. So all these things mean that, you know, that supply and demand curve, that meme that I thought is destroying Western civilization, one of the ways it's destroying is making it impossible for people to live in a house.
So is the ideal situation then, in terms of ownership, look, if you can afford to own a house, then, you know, fantastic, you do it, you get all the benefits that entails. If you can't, which is which is more than a third of the population, in some places it's half the population. In Geneva, I think it's 12% of properties are owner occupied. So, you know, because the houses are so expensive, that's the problem. But if the rest of the housing stock was all owned not by individuals who've got second or third properties, not by this increasing number of institutional investors, but actually government owned, government provided, like you said in Singapore of old, that would be a better situation, wouldn't it? So we say own one if you can. If not, it's the duty of the government to provide housing for everybody who can't afford to own themselves.
Yeah, and that'd be a more effective system than we have right now, again, because housing is such a bad fit into the bad model of the market economy that all politicians and policymakers and most of the public have in their heads, this supply and demand model. So, yeah, I mean, just to give, I was looking earlier in our conversation for a chart that I wanted to give an idea of the decline in home ownership that's occurred because we've allowed both private ownership of housing, private provision of housing, and also letting the finance sector lever up housing, so you have to borrow more and more money to buy a house. So if you go back to 1989, the number of people who owned their own home outright in Australia was 43% of the population. The objective was to increase that through government policy. It was 43% in 1989. It was 29% into 2019. So you've had a dramatic fall. At the same time, the people who hold the house with a mortgage has gone from 29% to 38% over that same time period. And the number of people living in private tenancy, of course, has gone in the opposite direction, from 17% to 28%. So we've had a complete failure. The policies that the governments have done to try to improve house owning has actually just increased the leverage. The system itself doesn't lend itself to supply and demand thinking in the very first place. And we're stuck in the situation where many, many young people basically despair of ever owning a home. And I'm looking forward to the days when they become the dominant components in electoral campaigns, because we might see the end of some of the crazy policies that have got here in the first place.
So in Singapore, the government was worried about the affordability of housing, also the fact that because Singapore was growing, they needed so many more properties, and hence that concern about affordability. So the government did build a lot of high-rise apartments that weren't rented out. They were sold effectively at cost to residents. So it wasn't a case of social housing as such. It's just that the government built them rather than allowing private developers to do it. The problem is, of course, because people own them, they're now selling them. And lots of those individual apartments are now going for more than $1 million. So they've joined the crazy housing cycle like the rest of us. So the Singapore experiment, good for a while, but they should have just asked people to pay rent rather than buying the house, shouldn't they? And then they would have been on the right track, but a lot of them were owned.
Like this, the UK's okay began at the same time with the buy to rent, or the and also the, when they started selling off the council housing.
Own your own home. Own your own home.
But one of the most remarkable stats I've seen in looking at economic data over time is the level of private debt in the UK before the deregulation that Thatcher brought in, which enabled banks to lend for housing rather than building societies. And when building societies lend, when you get involved in a building society, it's called a building society for a reason. You've got to join it. You then pay your money in over time, and then after some point, you can save a sufficient deposit to be able to buy a house, and then you withdraw that money plus the remainder you need from the society itself, and you have to repay it back into that pool. That, because the building society cannot take deposits, it also can't create loans the way that banks do. So the money in the building society account goes down, yours goes up, and then you repay it. There's no creation of money involved in that. So these are going on stats which have been changed by the redefinition of the stats recently, so it might not fit the actual numbers you'll see from the ONS now. But from 1880 until 1980, the level of private debt in the UK never exceeded 75% of GDP. Shortly after Thatcher did that deregulation, it started rising and it hit 210% of GDP. And a vast majority of that was mortgage debt. So this is that's what drove up house prices. So it's letting the finance sector rip. So the only way, you said earlier, the only way is to provide social housing. The other would be to get the banking sector out of housing finance, or to limit their capacity to create money, because the creating money for housing is what actually drives up the price of housing. So
loans can only equal deposits, basically.
Not quite, but yeah. In a sense, when you look back at the building society days, that was the case. The loans to loan money for somebody to buy a house or to build a house reduced the amount of money in the building society account. It didn't increase the amount of money in the system. It therefore didn't lever up house prices. So letting levered ownership of assets get into the house, that is what's caused the unaffordability of housing today.
The only problem is, if you bring down the house price of houses for those people who've got an expensive house, if you make that cheaper as well, they've got a slug of money left over, which obviously goes back into the finance sector. They just buy stocks and shares or some other asset class rather than housing, don't they? I mean, the finance sector is still going to grab it any which way they can.
They're going to try. But, I mean, what we have to realise is how dangerous it is to let leverage set the level of asset prices. And again, this is where my naive and stupid discipline of economics becomes a problem, because with a concept that students of economics learn in their finance courses called the Medicaliana-Miller hypothesis. I think the double M hypothesis, it's the alliteration probably helps in people taking it seriously, argue that leverage has no effect on asset prices, because somebody who has no leverage can buy shares in a highly levered company, or somebody can use leverage to buy shares in a company with no leverage. So overall level leverage doesn't affect asset prices. Now you take a look at the data against that proposition, and the data actually, the regression analysis of that argument that there's no relationship between leverage and asset prices, the correlation coefficient is BULLSHIT. It is absolute nonsense. When you look at the data, categorically reject that hypothesis. Leverage determines asset prices. So if you want to keep asset prices too high, you'll reduce the level of leverage.
Yeah, and everyone knows who's got, you know, got their eye on a house. There's a whole load of people there standing at an auction, which is the way houses are normally sold in Australia. Everyone's been to the bank to see how much they can borrow. That's how much they're going to bid for that house. It's whatever the bank's told them to, the maximum they can bid for. It's whoever's got the best offer from their bank. Nothing at all to do with the house.
Exactly.
So we're not going to get people off this idea of owning. I like this quote from, I wondered why we did own. So I went to psychologytoday.com. Regan Gurung is the psychology pundit. He says, we buy things because they release pleasure chemicals in the brain.
Endorphins.
Being the first to buy.
Dopamine. Yeah.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Being the first to buy something can make a person feel special. Having more stuff is a sign of prosperity and an easy way to flaunt one's status if you're into that. But, you know, we're never going to change that, are we? We have to.
Yeah, and that psychology is under, you know, this part of being human. So, but that's what's being exploited by letting the finance sector lever up the amount we buy. And that, you know, we're exploiting human frailty. We're not accommodating human frailty, but we're exploiting.
Does that mean then? And I was going to talk more. We just talked about housing. We're running out of time now. I was going to talk about more ownership. I was going to talk about company ownership, for example, and whether, you know, that falls in the hands of too few. Conversation for another day. But we could also talk about the other big household item, is buying a car. And there are companies now offering monthly subscriptions, which to me sounds fantastic. If you, for example, if I only need a car, like I'm, you know, going to be away for a couple of months, I don't need a car for that 2 months. But also, if we've got autonomous vehicles that can drive anywhere, then you could just call up the car when you wanted it. It doesn't need to be your car. You can't leave stuff in the boot, obviously. And someone's going to have to clean it. But that sounds like a great future. The only problem is, at the moment, car companies are saying, hey, don't buy the car. You can buy it on you can have it on subscription, or you can lease it. But it's not the car company that's actually facilitating that. They're still teaming up with the finance sector, aren't they? The finance sector is getting in there saying, well, okay, we'll buy the car and we'll lease that to you and we'll clip the ticket as part of that process. If it was just the car company, I can see the benefits, because the car company would say, well, we want this car to last as long as possible because we're renting it out. Therefore, we need to make sure it's made out of really good parts that are just not going to fail. We need everything, you know, this rather than, you know, we don't need built-in obsolescence. We need this car to last forever. But it's not happening that way, because they're just building the same old cars and then selling them to the finance sector, who are then offering it as a subscription or on a lease, which is sort of like an opportunity missed, isn't it?
It is, and we'll continue missing them, I'm afraid. Just humans' capacity to work out the right thing and do it, I think it's the smallest number you can find to one over infinity. Ain't going to happen.
Well, okay. I do like that idea, though.
I'm getting more cynical with
age. You are, aren't you? But that idea of it, but I can see us swinging more towards the idea of a subscription model. Well, we do it, don't we, online?
Well, it takes a change in the production system as well, and that's sort of with the you know, the box housing and factory produced housing and things like that. It means that sort of thing is feasible. But you know, at the moment, is the housing being the real issue, but we are just making it impossible for people to have that ownership. And we're wondering why people are talking more about socialism.
Well, actually, they're not, though, are they? They're talking the opposite of socialism. More and more people are talking about, well, talking about socialism as though it's a bad thing. I mean,
you're talking to the wrong people. I'm talking about the young people I deal with these days. The rise in acceptance of socialism, which is something that people thought was eliminated by the fall of the Berlin Wall and so on. It's making a comeback. And the reason is because people aren't seeing the young people aren't seeing the capitalist vision that the older people think they're bringing about. What they're seeing is a return to feudalism, and they're voting with their political sentiments, and the political sentiments of the young are shifting strongly in favour of socialism.
It doesn't explain why Nigel Farage has got so much young vote.
No, it's anti-migrant. I'm not saying we're perfect.
Okay. Yeah. All right, very good. Well, the shift has started to happen then, Steve. It would be good to see that innovation at the same time, wouldn't it? I do feel like, I mean, you know, post-war, we rolled out a lot of prefabricated houses. I mean, they were awful. You'd think technology had moved forward somewhat. And of course, that was government. A lot of that was government provided. So all we're doing is asking to go back to where we were post-war, when we had a population problem and we fixed it, but the government fixed it.
Yeah, it's now it's possible. I mean, technological innovation can mean that housing becomes a mass production item, and that might well address it ultimately. But you know, to me, the trap is in our thinking. The supply and demand, the Marshall's cross is what we're all being crucified on.
Good point to leave it on, Steve. We'll catch you again next week. Thank you.
Okay, mate. Bye.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.